This is Ahval Online, meeting point of accurate news and free comment on the current affairs of Turkey. Welcome to our podcast series. Hello and welcome to this conversation at Ahval and Hot Pursuit. For the listeners, we are going to analyze, put light on Libya. It's a growing saga. Possibly, according to the analysis, it's the beginning of the Libya saga. International Gordian's knot at the moment, involving mainly Turkey as the main actor, but also involving more than 7-8 nations, including Egypt, Tunisia, Greece, Cyprus, France, Italy, Russia, United States of America, even more. But we will try to keep it in that context with my colleague Cengiz Aktar, columnist with Ahval. Hello, Cengiz.
Hello, Yavuz.
Now, we can begin with the sort of describing the gravity of the situation, because as you and I quite clearly see, there is, at least, to say the least, confusion in the in the analysis and observations on the conflict, which has been brewing for a long time, even before the COVID-19 epidemic hit the globe. And this was somehow a crisis that screamed that it was coming. And it developed into something huge at the moment. It's snowballed into something that is not comparable to any other conflict, because it is encompassing the entire East Mediterranean basin. And we forgot also the Israel also could be included in the nations that
and Greece.
And Greece I mentioned already. Yep. So everything has to do with the changes, radical changes and shifts in the paradigm of Turkish foreign policy. And we can begin with a quote that I'm sure most of the international observers have not been aware of, because I haven't seen any English translation of it anywhere. It's by a recent statement by Devlet Bahçeli, the leader of the ultranationalistic MHP party, who is the main partner of Erdogan government, and if you ask me, de facto president of Turkey, because he is calling the shots at the moment. And what Bahçeli said, I'm quoting, "Everyone should know that the Turkish nation, if it is pushed into a self-isolation or a retreat, and also to an indifference to the development in its vicinity, it will cause irreparable risks for our homeland in the mid and long run." And he continues, quote, "The ultimate defense line of the homeland shall have to begin with the thresholds defined in the map of national oath or national pact, Misak-ı Milli. If Turkey makes any concessions from its rights, its thesis, and its ideals, it will mean making all of them debatable, open to debate. The sole ground for our presence in the adjacent territories and countries is the interpretation, our interpretation, he means, of our national security and international law. Let it be known by everyone that if we ever retreat from those areas across our borders, if we buckle under the threats, Turkish homelands will be subject to simultaneous attacks by the traitors and oppressors." I think this, in a nutshell, summarizes of current Turkey's outlook to the immediate region, I think. Now we have Libya. And I know that you are following Libyan conflict on day-by-day basis. Where are we at the latest? And what kind of conclusions we can draw, what to make out of this one?
I think what you have quoted from Devlet Bahçeli, who is de facto number two of the regime, if not number one, as you put it, it's very evocative, I think. It's an old theory. I mean, the best defense is the offensive action. And this is where Turkey is today. The problem is that Turkey has many neighbors and many neighborhoods. I'm afraid the Turkish capabilities, be it military or financial, don't allow that many fronts. So Libya is one of these fronts, a relatively new one. Syria is another one. Iraq is another one. There are prospective fronts in Cyprus, Eastern Mediterranean, and the Aegean. And that gives the impression that this is a country which aims at what it doesn't have the means and capabilities of controlling at the end of the day. And this is where we are, not only in Syria, but also in Libya. So there has been major developments the last 1 month and a half in the field of operations, actually, in Libya. And it's growing by the day. Now, very first observation is that Turkish officials and pro-Turkish international press, be it from the Arab world or elsewhere, are systematically talking. Whereas the opponents, I mean, those who don't agree with the way Turkey is conducting its operations and dealing with the Tripoli government, mainly Russia, France, Egypt, and United Arab Emirates. Maybe we can add to it many others, and to start with Saudi Arabia. They don't talk as much Turkey or pro-Turks. That tells a lot. I mean, it means that I think they have crossed the Rubicon.
They crossed the Rubicon, you think?
I think they crossed the Rubicon because, I mean, they keep saying that we will take Sirte. And who said that? Erdogan himself said that. I mean, this is, in terms of international relations and diplomatic habits of today's world, it's very, very unusual. I mean, any country can conclude a bilateral or multilateral defense agreement with other countries, but I mean that doesn't allow these contractor countries to speak on the name of the contracting country, and this is unseen in the diplomacy. I'll give you an example of Russia, for instance. I mean, Russia has a military defense agreement with Damascus. Have you ever heard any Russian official talking about taking Idlib, for instance? It doesn't exist, because it cannot exist, because it's absurd. I mean, that, of course, expose Turkey and many people in the world today, be it, you know, aware or unaware of what is really happening in Libya. People tell Turkey, ask them themselves, are you intending to invade Libya? this is where we are.
Okay, but let's go deeper into this. I think one may call these conflicts that are sort of expanded upon by Turkey, particularly Libya, but also Syria, but Libya now, most of all, and East Med, they are tightly linked to the Turkish domestic politics. So they are the reason why they are so loudly repeated every day by Bahçeli or by Erdogan or their spokesperson or their media has to do, of course, with the political engineering dimension of it, because they need this reinvented and reproduced national rhetoric every day. This is part of the Turkish political reality, whether one accepts it or not. It is there. But this explains automatically what one faces, what you criticize, what as different from Lavrov or Putin or any other leader in the similar contexts. Turkish leaders are in desperate need for this nationalist reproduction of rhetoric, linked also with expansion and expansive moves, expansionist moves. But we have also a red line, which you can discuss whether one passed the Rubicon or not. The red line is a red line drawn between Sirte and Jufra, as emphasized in the ceasefire declaration by Egypt. So Egypt's conditionality is, if you come near and try to cross that, if you take over Sirte, it will be sort of a casus belli or reason for Egyptian forces also entering into the theater with full force. But at the same time, there are other mechanisms triggered now, Cengiz, because as we said in the beginning, this is only the initial phases of this management of this conflict. For example, there is, as you observed, pressure from the American side or international side to Sarraj government to dismantle and dissolve what many see as bundles of mercenaries, jihadist mercenaries exported by Turkey from Syria. And this puts another dimension into this. And American pressure is there. France's disgruntlement is there. So what do we make of this?
There are too many things, I mean, here. Let me start with the Turkey unchecked. I call it Turkey unchecked. Mm. So I think, this need for foreign action to hide what is really happening in the country and to play the nationalist card, because after all, the Turkish public opinion, be it pro-regime or against the regime, is very happy to see the Turkish victorious armies running around the world. So this is one element. But, I mean, in the meantime, when you are so overconfident, you start to make mistakes. And one of the biggest mistakes that they have done, these guys in Ankara, is to export the jihadists or the Muslim terrorists, let's call the cat a cat, from Syria to Libya. Because in Syria, they were unchecked. And until today, they are unchecked. No one tells Turkey, hey, what are you doing with all these terrorists? To the contrary. I mean, the dire state of the United States administration gives Turkey all sorts of hopes and green lights in Syria. They thought they could continue with this in Libya. And that was, I think, where they made a big mistake. I have the following reading regarding Libya. Frankly, under the international rules, if Turkey would have concluded a military defense and cooperation agreement with the Tripoli government, like Russia with the Damascus government, or like France with the Mali government, for instance. I mean, frankly, and send, according to this agreement, Turkish soldiers, but real Turkish soldiers, to Libya. We wouldn't arrive there where we are today. No one could have challenged this. And basically, I mean, there would have been other problems, but not this one. Because today, the bottom line of all this debate about what Turkey is doing in Libya is the presence of tens of thousands of jihadists or Muslim terrorists in the western part of the country, by the Tunisian border, by the Algerian border, because Libya has also a border with Algeria mm-hmm. in the south, of course. And this is the bottom line. And this is also the bottom line for Egypt. This is also a bottom line for Europe. I mean, no one among these three or four, you know, one group and three neighboring countries of Libya could accept the presence. It's not even the case of Muslim Brotherhood. It's more than that, of Muslim jihadis in their neighborhood. This is the bottom line. And this is the message, actually, Sisi, Abdel Fattah el-Sisi, the Putschist ruler, the Putschist ruler and president of Egypt. I mean, he's not, he's far from being a Democrat. But nevertheless, he was clear enough, I think that was a week ago, who said that this is unacceptable for us. And we will go for it. So I think where we are today, there are some symbolic deadlines like the 15th of July, the so-called coup d'etat's fourth anniversary. And those who follow the military matters in Turkey expect a military move before that to take, conquer, actually, Sirte and Jufra. And we will see how it will develop. But in the meantime, the others are not just waiting for Turkey. I think we should say Turkey now. Turkey and its jihadists. To move. President Macron is expected in Moscow to meet President Putin. There are all sorts of military activity towards Sirte and Jufra, and Egypt is getting ready. So I think we are in a waiting mood now.
But in terms of the agenda, there is now a pending, perhaps prospective move within the United Nations Security Council, perhaps.
Of course.
There are some moves within NATO, which is less significant, I think, because Security Council, its moves will matter if it does move.
You know, before it comes to the Security Council in form of a new Libya resolution, frankly, I mean, the message of the world after the so-called Cairo Declaration by the government of Egypt was very sound and clear, and the entire world, including China, has called upon the parties, Tobruk, Benghazi on the one hand, Trablus, Tripoli on the other hand, to cease the fire. Mm-hmm. And what was the answer of the Tripoli? Tripoli rejected this call, rejected to attend the Arab League meeting, and on the name of Tripoli, Turkey also talked. And they say it is unacceptable to continue, and we will continue until we take Sirte. This is what I was mentioning in the beginning. You don't do this kind of things in the international diplomacy, you know. But anyhow, there is no diplomacy. So I think the heavyweight is definitely Egypt, who shares more than 1,000 kilometers of border with Libya. And according to some recent information that I gathered, Sisi was waiting for the finalization of a $6.5 billion loan from IMF. And that happened last week, and he feels more
confident,
confident and free now. And that's the first element. And the second element, which is indirectly in connection with the fuss in Libya, is the next agreement between Greece and Egypt regarding the delimitation of the exclusive economic zones of the two countries. That will that is expected no later than mid-August, apparently. So 1 month and a half from now. And that will have, of course, a tremendous effect on the so-called memorandum between Ankara and Tripoli, with this tangent, you know, which goes from the Turkish coasts to Tripoli, which is it's unique in the annals of the UNCLOS, the 1982 international agreement on the delimitation of the EEZs in the world. So that will cut this Turkish-Libyan tangent completely, you know, the Greek-Egyptian agreement. So all in all, I think if we try to sum up what is at stake today, some people think, and I also tend to think on behalf of the Turkish regime, that they may expect, you know, to become the game maker in Libya by invading Sirte and Jujufra so to control the Libyan oil. I mean, I checked the international companies present in the country.
Field.
Yes, the biggest, of course, is Eni of Italy. By far, I mean, it's really huge stakes in Libya. Total, the French company, ConocoPhillips, the U.S. company, Spain's Repsol is there too. Austria's OMV is there. Norway's State Oil, Equinor, it's the new name, and Rosneft of Russia. So, and the Turkish petroleum is not there, for instance. So why I'm saying this? Because, you know, even if you control Sirte, these companies have, clear-cut agreements with the governments, with the government of Libya. I mean, in for the matter is the Tripoli government. Mm-hmm. I mean, no one can challenge unless this challenger expects to pay hundreds of billions of liabilities penalties to these companies and to get rid of the concessions that these companies have already, you know, with the National Oil Company of Libya. That's the first thing. The second point is, I would like to repeat this because in Ankara, many people don't get this. The bottom line of the entire fuss, I repeat, the chaos that is ongoing in the country is the presence of the mainly Syrian mercenaries, otherwise the jihadis and the Muslim terrorists. Mm-hmm. I mean, they are already acting in the towns that they have recaptured, like Tarhuna, for instance, which is completely destroyed. And
allegedly coordinated by Turkish officers or paramilitary groups such as reported.
Sadat, and America and United States is putting heavy pressure now by virtue of the Skirat agreement under the security arrangements, Article 35, which clearly says whatever the security concerns of the country could be, it is not allowed to cooperate or protect jihadis, jihadi groups, as listed by the UN Security Council. And it quotes Al-Qaeda, ISIS and Al-Ansar, who are all present today in Tripoli.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll have to add also that it seems at the moment, mm-hmm. again, back to Security Council, four of the five permanents seem to be more or less in agreement about the pressure on through ceasefire, which is mm-hmm. China, France, Russia,
UK.
UK, USA. UK is still murky at in this game because, but as it seems, it may reach a consensus again. That being said, again another obscure point, seemingly obscure point, which might be added in the bigger picture is maybe it is not yet clearly understood by the Western observers. Is in the and also part. It's a major factor in the game making of Ankara is that the claims of Erdogan and what he represents and what he wants to continue to represent is as the lead force of the waning declining Muslim Brotherhood stream globally speaking.
You know, I call it Muslim Brotherhood International.
This was seemed quite promising during the Arab Awakening. As we see now, let's face the facts, it could never have a foothold in Iraq because of the construction and constellations in Iraq. It tried an experiment in Syria, but it imploded or it was exploded. Or destroyed for a long time, and Russian presence is there, and also Assad presence and Russian presence combined is making it nearly impossible for a revival. But this doesn't mean that the Muslim Brotherhood ideals, Ikhwanism, political Islam, as a sort of a one-party regime ideal, is not going to be revived elsewhere. So. What we see is a shift of the ground or territory in the leadership, persistent leadership of Erdogan towards Libya. That's there, among other things, that's where he sees his chances of leading such a movement or being a sort of a carrier of such a movement. This is something that's not really clearly seen by Europe. If you want to analyze this, you have to put this in the bigger picture. Because if Erdogan is successful, which is still 50-50 if you ask me, then you will have a very strong presence of a sort of a jihadi regime on the southern borders of European Union. And this will have also an impact and consequences towards the south, towards the inner sides of Africa and also Egypt, as you clearly made it clear why Sisi is so firm in his standing, because he does not want to see another Ikhwan movement coming in and starting to rise again. So this is where the stakes are. To put it objectively. This is what Erdogan wants.
Frankly, he wants.
He wants. And this is what France doesn't want. This is what Greece is worried about. Israel too. And this is what especially Trump knows nothing about. This is where the U.S. non-policy is. I think, Cengiz, if the history is written, when the history is written in the future, and if this conflict blows up to something unmanageable, one way or another, all blame will be put on Trump, because for Erdogan to be successful, Erdogan and Bahçeli in this policy, it will have to have a continuity in Trump's indecisive, ignorant viewpoint on Libya. And Erdogan takes advantage of that. The timing of Libyan conflict and explosion or blow up, blowing up of in Libyan conflict is synchronized clearly with the
NATO.
With the way Trump behaves or not behaves. He will be the culprit in the future if something really unmanageable happens in terms of Libyan crisis.
Well, I'm not an expert on military matters, thank God. But as I see it, I mean, frankly, objectively speaking, I don't think Ankara regime has got any chance to settle in northern Africa. I don't think so. I mean, it will end up really badly. And I'm actually expecting, you know, a fiasco in Libya for the Ankara regime might even mean the end of this regime. This is definitely in the cards. This is one of the possibilities. So what I'm expecting, actually, Turkey at the end of the day, sooner or later, will have to live with its dear jihadists that it's feeding since years, since at least 2013-14. So it's more than six years. So these guys, in tens of thousands of them, including Turks among them, many, you know, they will, the only place they will, you know, they will go, or they could go, will be Turkey. And Turkey will have to deal with it. And because these, you know, when we talk about the vicinity of Europe, we should, I repeat, talk also about the vicinity of the neighboring countries of Libya. Mind you, in the mid-90s, Algeria, you know, Algeria, it was a horrible, you know, civil war where 150,000 people was killed at least in a very, you know, short time, few months actually. And that was, again, that was the first anti-Ihvan, anti-Muslim Brotherhood, you know, war by, you know, a North African country. So Algeria is still there. Tunisia, we know how the things are developing, and also they are deadly, you know, afraid of what is happening in their vicinity, and Egypt. So I think, and plus Europe, I mean, Italy, France, Spain, I mean, this is really a mission impossible for Mr. Bahçeli and Mr. Erdoğan.
At the same time, this is, I think, what I see as the most adventurous move by yep. Turkish government, by any Turkish government, set aside 1974 because it was a very limited action in Cyprus, comparable to 1914 decision to take, to drag yep. Turkey, late Ottoman Empire, into the First World War.
You're right.
This was a period, that was a period of extreme adventurism out of despair. And now there are similarities again with this, with that one, and it's it goes under the banner. I think it's quite a passing expression that was established by İlhan Uzgel. Impressive article actually he wrote, and he says military first, like America first. He was making some sort of comparison to or relation to that expression. Military first is the banner. And he's also using quite useful expression, actually, to define the current foreign policy of Turkey as forward defense. I think, in line with what Bahçeli is trying to tell the world in despair, because the world doesn't listen to what he says. But he's a man of his word. And he's calling the shots, as I said. Forward defense is there.
It's called the best defense is the offense. It's called the best
defense. This is defense. What makes adventurism so visible at the moment.
Indeed.
And also linked to an agenda. As you know, the July agenda is going to be filled with such elements, such as Hagia Sophia perhaps being converted into a mosque in the coming days, actually, maybe, and also the what you mentioned, anniversary of the attempted coup fourth anniversary, which of course will be filled with symbolism, maybe also with expectations, because what we've been hearing lately, I mean, in the past 48 hours or so, there is an offensive being prepared against Sirte. And one of them expresses this or gives expression to this one is a former officer turned columnist Metin Gürcan. He says, and I read it, despite ceasefire calls from Moscow and others, Ankara's operational preparations suggest that its allies in Libya might attempt to advance towards Sirte and Al-Jufra in the second half of July. But again, what you said, Turkey's capabilities, its inability or incompetence maybe to establish a foothold in Africa, to expand there, is there as well, and is being touched upon by Metin Gürcan as well in the article. And he says a failure to match military efforts with diplomacy could prevent operational achievements from translating into sustainable diplomatic gains, and says, which means there is a fight going on in Ankara. Many in Ankara have come to question to what extent the ailing Turkish economy could sustain costly military ventures abroad and the defense industry, a concern that bears directly on Ankara's military activism in Libya. Maybe this could be a good point to conclude our chat about Libyan crisis. This is a very critical junction that Turkey finds itself in.
Yeah.
Nothing to add. Okay.
No, of course, so we can have millions of things to add, but no, I think one...
We can take it up in our next conversation.
One point. I mean, this will be one of the subjects of my future articles in Ahval. Actually, contrary to the past period, I mean, before the present regime, you know, Turkey's Turkey's foreign policy mottos was peace at home, peace abroad. So this is over. And Turkish society it's not only the foreign policy, the entire Turkey, entire Turkish polity, as we call it, and the Turkish economy is militarizing. You know, the Turkish militarization, you know, it really sounds like the post-Versailles militarization of Germany after 1919. And everybody should be aware of that, especially the arms dealers, to start with Germany and Italy and Spain, who are happily selling arms and very high-tech military material to Ankara.
We can continue, go on, but let's keep other aspects to our next conversation about Libyan crisis. Cengiz Aktar, thank you for this conversation.
You can follow Ahval News online podcast series through Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, Google Podcasts, SoundCloud, and Spreaker. All you need to know about Turkey is here, for your ears, mind, and attention. Thank you for listening to our podcast.